Hello, Shiver Seekers. Are you ready to follow us into the unknown? I'm Cynthia.
And I'm Stephanie. You have found the Dark Oak.
Today we discuss the very mysterious, highly debated disappearance and ultimate death of four-year-old Paulette Hebara Fara.
Welcome to The Dark Oak, the mystery podcast with purpose. Each month through our charity called the Branch of Hope Foundation, we give a portion of earnings from our Patreon and sponsors to a nonprofit organization related to the first episode of the month. That's today, guys. We're going to tell you about our new Branch of Hope organization today. Now, to find out how you can be part of the movement, head over to thedarkoak.com or stay with us until the end of the episode and we will give you all the details.
Thanks, Stephanie. And hey, it's good to be back.
She's back.
Oh, man.
She's back with her sultry, sick voice.
That's right. I very much like Phoebe Buffay, tend to get a sexy voice after being sick. So here she is. Lucky, lucky listeners. But can I just... I have to give you and Bart a shout out for last week's episode because you guys killed it. You were awesome. And Bart was so good. And though I would have loved to have been here, and especially given the circumstances, I would have really loved to have been here. But Bart was able to bring such amazing information that I would not have been able to give. So it worked out so beautifully.
You know what's interesting? I mean, we lived together. Both of us work from home, so we're together all the time. And I knew he would be a great co-host, especially for the topic. But he was so level-headed about talking about possible UFO, like, encounters. You know what I mean? Like, to talk to him, he is not one that plays into conspiracy theories or any kind of anomalies. But he shot down every one of the skeptics' opinions with a lot of savvy, I think.
Oh, for sure, because I mentioned to you that one of those more reasonable explanations, I was like, oh, that's totally what happened, until Bart said, nope, that couldn't have happened, and here's why. So,
I should tell our listeners, if you haven't heard, this is from last week's episode, the abduction, possible abduction of Frederick Valentich. I mean, it's a disappearance for sure, and I don't know. I feel like it's pretty compelling that it may have been a otherworldly encounter. And it was a lot of fun.
It was so fun. And if you're not familiar with the case, you must go back and listen. But Fred was actually flying a Cessna airplane. And Bart, Stephanie's husband, who co-hosted, is a Navy pilot, or was a Navy pilot. So he was able to bring so much, like, firsthand experience to what could have possibly happened up there. It was really awesome. Please check it out. I loved it. And it was really fun to just be a listener. So thank you again. And thank you so much, Bart, for filling in for me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, he may be back. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, he was awesome. Well, Stephanie, I can tell you that the case I'm going to bring to you today is definitely one of the most bizarre cases that I personally have ever talked about here at the Dark Oak. Today's story takes place in Mexico, and this case is often referred to as the Mexican JonBenet Ramsey case. And you're going to see why. You're going to see those parallels between the two cases as we go along.
I'm glad we're finally able to get to this one, because I know you've talked about it several times, how it just makes no sense.
Most of the time, in the cases that we discuss, I'm able to, like, come up with my own theory of what I think probably happened, and I'm pretty confident that it's reasonable. This is one of those cases where I just don't see how things unfolded the way they did. I just cannot wrap my mind around it. So yeah, this one definitely makes my wheels spin a bit.
Was it hard for you to get information on it because it's from Mexico? Like, how did that work?
You know, actually it was, because a lot of the source material is in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish. I don't read Spanish. But fortunately, I was able to find some sources that took the police reports and things of that nature and was able to translate them. This has been a pretty highly covered case, which is always scary because you want to make sure you get accurate information.
Right.
And we've learned that, yeah, you know, what's reported is not always accurate, but I was able to confirm a lot of my sources with secondary sources. So hopefully we're bringing you, you know, the most up-to-date information and accurate information that we can.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know much about like the Mexican media and anything. So I don't know how they report on a lot of these things. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how the investigation went and how all this worked out. Oh boy. Well, okay.
It will be interesting.
Okay. All right. Well, that's ominous.
Right. Right. Well, for those of you who don't know about this case, Paulette Hebara Farah was a 4-year-old little girl who was discovered missing from her own bed in her own home. So let me tell you a little bit about Paulette and her family. Paulette's parents were 38-year-old Mauricio, who worked in real estate, and 34-year-old Lizette, who was the daughter of a prominent Lebanese immigrant family. And Lizette herself was a former attorney who decided to stay home with her children when she became a mom. And together, Maurice and Lizette had 2 children, a 7-year-old daughter, also named Lizette.
Okay.
So for the sake of clear storytelling, I'm going to call her Little Lizette for the rest of the
Makes
episode.
Sense. Sure.
And then their youngest daughter was 4-year-old Paulette. Paulette was born July 20th, 2005, at only 25 weeks gestation.
Oh, tiny.
So tiny. She was severely premature. Most of our listeners probably know this, but in case you don't, generally, babies are born at 40 weeks gestation. So she was just a little over halfway. Very, very premature.
And I'm sorry, tell me the year again.
2005.
Okay, so technology had kind of advanced enough, medicine had advanced enough that, because, I mean, not that long ago, 25 weeks gestation, you wouldn't even, not even survivable.
Correct. I think the youngest, and this is just based off of memory from when I was pregnant, but I think the absolute youngest an infant has ever survived, the earliest gestation was maybe 22 weeks. So they were very, very close to that, you know, rate of not being able to survive this. In fact, Paulette's doctors told Mauricio and Lizette that she probably was not going to survive.
Oh, so scary.
Very scary. She was only 12 inches long. She weighed less than 2 pounds at birth.
So
I mean, just tiny. But miraculously, she lived.
Okay.
However, the left side of her body was left impaired, and as she grew, that affected her ability to speak as well as her mobility. So doctors then prepared her family for the fact that Paulette was probably never going to walk or talk. But once again, Paulette was going to do things her way. And by 4 years old, she was able to take a few steps, and she could also say simple words like mama.
Okay.
So Paulette was really beating the odds and doing amazing things.
Sure.
However, given her disabilities, she did require constant supervision and pretty costly medical care and therapies, as you would, you know, imagine.
Sure.
So to help with the caretaking, the family employed 2 live-in nannies who also worked as housekeepers. And these nannies were sisters named Erica and Martha.
Okay.
On March 10th, 2010, the evening before Paulette went missing, the family had arrived home to their upscale apartment complex in Huixquilucan, Mexico, which was a wealthy suburb of Mexico City.
Why does that sound so exotic?
I don't know, but let me tell you, trying to pronounce it.
not quite as fanciful, huh?
Wow. By looking at the letters in this word, I would have never have come up with that proper pronunciation. So thank God for some Google Translate.
And native Spanish speakers that help us along.
Absolutely. Thanks, Yvette.
Yeah.
So the family arrived home in their apartment complex after being on 2 separate vacations. So Lizette had gone to Los Cabos with a friend while Mauricio and the kids vacationed in Valle de Bravo.
I want a vacation with these folks.
I know, right? Both of those. I would take either one of those vacations.
Absolutely.
Now, that evening, Lizette got Paulette ready for bed. And this included a special bedtime routine of putting like body pillows all around Paulette and then tucking her in relatively tightly with blankets to keep her from rolling around and falling off the bed.
Okay, to kind of like give her more stability.
Right. So at least for me, when I used to like lay my babies down in my bed for a nap or something, yeah, I'd always put pillows and blankets all around them to kind of keep them cocooned in,
sure,
from falling off the bed. And this was just part of the nighttime routine given Paulette's mobility issues.
Sure, that makes sense.
The next morning, the two nannies, Erica and Martha, woke little Lizette up in time for her to get dressed and ready for school and then get to the bus by 7 a.m. So she had a pretty early morning. Paulette had just started kindergarten, but the kindergarten class started a little later in the day, so she was able to sleep until 8 a.m. in the mornings. Lucky her.
Yeah.
So at 8 a.m. that morning, Erica went into Paulette's room to wake her up, but she was surprised to find the bed empty with no signs of Paulette anywhere in the room.
Okay, and she was only able to take like a few steps at a time, so she should not have just not been in the bed.
She should not have been. I mean, I guess given enough time, she probably could have like wiggled her way out, but this was unusual.
This was unusual. Okay, got it.
So Erica, of course, did what we all would do. She first checked the most obvious places, like the closet and the bathroom. At one point, Martha even came in to help look for Paulette. But after they didn't find her, they started doing a little more of an intensive search. So they lifted up the blankets and the mattress and the pillows. And when they still couldn't find Paulette, they went and told Mauricio and Lizette that their daughter appeared to be missing. As you mentioned, given Paulette's mobility issues, this was beyond strange because, again, she was able to take some steps, but she would not have been able to get up and out of her bed and leave the room on her own, at least not easily.
Sure.
So the family began searching the entire apartment, and when there was still no sign of the missing little girl, they expanded their search to the whole building. Now, at some point during all of this commotion, the police were notified. And it's reported that at least 100 officials were brought in to help search the entire property.
Whoa, okay, that's major.
Right. I mean, thankfully, because we got a missing little girl here, so this is serious.
Yeah.
They brought in scent dogs to, you know, help hopefully track Paulette's movement. Now, because she would not have been able to travel very far on her own, authorities quickly began to worry that Paulette had been the victim of an abduction.
Yeah. Or somebody did something they shouldn't have done.
Right. Very, very scary thoughts began swimming in everybody's head. So right away, a major search campaign was launched, and it didn't take long for the press to get on the case. Paulette's description and photograph were quickly distributed among media networks. Posters, flyers, and even billboards went up throughout the area, and the case quickly became a media sensation. Now, despite all of this attention, there really weren't any valuable leads. So Lizette started doing television interviews in an attempt to garner more attention. And these interviews were held in Paulette's bedroom with Lizette sitting on Paulette's bed, begging for the return of her daughter, going as far as to tell the alleged abductor that as long as they didn't hurt Paulette, but instead just dropped her off somewhere safe, the family would not seek any kind of punishment for the abductor.
Right.
But still, there was nothing. Now, I told you at the top of this episode that this case is often referred to as the Mexican JonBenet Ramsey case.
Yeah.
There are definitely some similarities between the two cases. And one of them is that the crime scene really was not preserved.
Well, with 100 people traipsing around, I was wondering how they kept that all kind of coordinated.
Exactly. Well, and actually, I said 100 because that's the more conservative side, but one publication I read even said up to 200 people.
Well, and I can see that. You hear about a four-year-old girl missing. I'm sure there were tons of volunteers that were coming out, family members. I mean, everybody's doing everything they can. However, we have this crime scene preservation that becomes a real issue.
Right, right. And I've heard it said by experts that as soon as the first investigator arrives on a scene, the scene is already contaminated. So imagine that multiplied with all of these people. I mean, that's
well, and also just even the initial search with them kind of going through the closet, going through the bed sheets, going under the mattress. Like, how do you, like, nothing is as it would have been when they first came in the room, I'm sure.
Exactly.
And now it's even less so.
You got it. So this crime scene was absolutely not preserved. Authorities did their initial search, but then countless people were allowed to go in and out of the apartment while the family was still living there, going as far as to allow TV crews in, like coming and going. Just imagine one film crew alone in a bedroom. You've got the interviewer, the interviewee, camera operators, mic operators, assistants. Like,
but again, I think, well, by the time they did the television interview, they definitely thought it could have possibly been criminal. But when the original volunteers showed up, they just thought maybe she had wandered away.
Right.
You know, so they didn't even know it was a crime, so to speak.
Right. But again, given her mobility issues, it shouldn't have taken long before they realized, hold on, like, this girl didn't just get up and walk away.
I don't know. If I'm those parents, it's just suspended reality for me. Like, she's got to be here. She couldn't have been abducted. You know what I'm saying?
You'd tear the room apart.
You would tear the room apart. Like, absolutely. I would be like, she's got to be here, because facing the alternative is just too much.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying, as a parent, I get it.
Oh, no. As far as the initial search goes, absolutely. You're not going to be worried about preserving evidence. You're going to be doing anything you can to find your missing little girl.
I guess what I'm saying is, in some ways, maybe this is a hindsight's 2020.
Okay. Okay.
But now, I mean, you're doing whole, like, interviews in the room with a TV crew. That's a whole nother thing for me. Now, I get it if you're Lizette, though, because you want to humanize her, you want to show she's loved, you want her returned. So I can see how putting a personal spin on it may have been her goal. But yeah, when it comes to forensics, it's a big no-no.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. And it even went as far as, at one point, Lizette's friend came into town to, you know, visit, to offer emotional support. And she was literally sleeping in Paulette's bed.
Oh.
So again, any evidence that may not have been gathered in that initial search, it was definitely contaminated very quickly. And I don't know, it just does seem a little strange to me.
That is strange to me.
When once they realized that, okay, we may be looking at something, you know, a little more sinister here, like, let's close this off.
Well, not to mention, it just would have seemed irreverent to me. I mean, I know everybody probably looks at it differently, but I would have said that's her bed and she's coming back home to it. I don't know. I would have felt that would have been a little strange. That's just my personal opinion.
I can imagine that if I were Lizette, I might have a hard time allowing somebody to sleep in my missing daughter's room. I think that would be hard for me.
Again, I'm not saying she's wrong for doing it. I'm just saying that's different than I would feel.
Yeah, I agree.
No, again, it's Mexico. It's a different culture. So maybe that's it's true. Different. You know what I'm saying? They're much more like multi-generational houses and things like that. So maybe it's not that big of a deal, but I don't know. For me, that would be a hard no.
For me, it would be a little too intimate, I think.
Yeah.
And personal.
Yeah.
And yeah, a little too sacred, I think.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, irreverent. Like, yeah. Kind of just like.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you.
That's the last time I saw her.
Right. This is where she went missing from.
This is where she went missing from.
Well, and imagine being the person.
I don't want you touching it.
Right. Imagine being the person sleeping in the bed. This is where she went missing from. And we don't know if somebody crept in the room. We don't know what happened.
No, all that seems weird to me.
The whole thing really seemed weird until you learn that investigators had been ordered to stop processing the crime scene almost as soon as they arrived. They were given the order to look for signs of forced entry, but nothing beyond that. So that's what they did. Now, these investigators admitted that because of these orders, the scene was never closed off. Police officers were even allowed to use Paulette's bathroom as they worked the scene.
Ooh.
Now, what was the motive for stopping the processing of this potential crime scene? No one really knows for sure. But one of the theories is that the family had friends in high places, and so they were given special treatment and allowed to stay in their home longer than maybe another family may have been. And we'll talk about that a little more later, about when we get into theories.
So as in, like, they didn't want to disrupt their lives?
I think maybe that may have been part of it. Or, you know, we even saw a little bit of that, I believe, in the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Yeah.
When you have this wealthy, well-to-do family, and they're given allowances, I think, that maybe other people would not have been given. And, you know, when they say, I'm calling my friend and my friend's coming over and she's going to be here, and just nobody stops it for whatever reason.
Well, and also, I mean, as we know, unfortunately, if a child goes missing, it's normally someone they know. So why was there no speculation put on the mother and father?
Well, eventually there was.
Eventually. But again, it took a while to get there. And so if there was any kind of crime scene, or if they were the ones that had committed the crime, they could just dispose or rid of any kind of evidence.
That's true. That's true. Now, I will say, you know, we're talking days here, not weeks, not months. So okay. We do end up learning where Paulette is within 9 days of her going missing.
Okay.
So a lot happened in those 9 days.
Right.
As the initial investigation progressed, authorities did find some inconsistencies with the initial abduction theory. So here we are, kind of to your point, starting to look at maybe it's somebody
fishy.
Little closer. There were no signs of forced entry in the apartment. And on top of that, Paulette's bedroom was on the second floor, and the only outside point of entry was a window that was neither broken or tampered with. Paulette's parents' bedroom was right next door to hers, but they didn't hear anything the night she went missing. The family's two dogs didn't bark at all during the night. The building had several security measures in place, including surveillance cameras. However, those cameras did not appear to have been working the night Paulette went missing.
Of course.
Of course. I mean, like, do we even need to say that? That's all of our cases.
Oh, my gosh.
And if there were any cameras that were still, you know, in use or working, none of them showed anything of any, you know, relevance.
Gotcha.
None of the building's residents saw or heard anything truly unusual that was raising red flags. Authorities also noted that no one ever came forward saying that they had taken Paulette, and no kidnapping demands were ever made, which one would assume would be the reason, or one of the reasons, for taking her in the first place.
Right.
But those weren't the only things that made this case, you know, a little unusual. During questioning, the nannies had a different version of how that morning had gone after Paulette was discovered missing. Their story was a little different than Mauricio and Lizette's. For one, according to these two sisters, instead of joining in on the search for her daughter, like she'd told authorities she had done, Lizette spent the morning just drinking coffee and chain-smoking cigarettes at the kitchen table.
Like, nervously smoking cigarettes? You know what I'm saying? I don't know. People react differently to scary things.
That's my thought. So, like, is it unusual that she said she helped search when in reality she was just sitting there smoking and drinking coffee? I mean, why lie? Unless maybe you are afraid they'll judge you or something. But if your kid's missing and you're just sitting there nervous and stressed, smoking sick, I mean, I get it. I can see somebody doing that and being so distraught that they wouldn't even be helpful in a search. I get that. But I think it's more the lying about it.
I'm not saying it's not peculiar at all. I'm just saying that on its own is not enough to make me raise my eyebrow, I guess.
I'm with you.
Okay.
How about this one? This one's a little bit more disturbing in my opinion. Lizette and Mauricio were not the ones who called the police. Instead, that morning, Mauricio had called his sister to let her know what was going on, and she was the one who decided to get the authorities involved.
Well, that's okay. We're going up the ladder here. That's more concerning, for sure.
I agree. That's a little more weird, especially if you're so nervous that you're just sitting at a table chain smoking. Then why wouldn't you call the police?
Yes, I see those together. And also, I would want to know what was the nature of that call with his sister. Was it, hey, we're freaking out, can you come over here and help us get it together. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. And so I could see that. Right. Like, listen, Lizette's losing her mind. I don't know what's going on. You've always been the voice of reason. Can you come over really quick and just make sure we've covered all the bases before we call the police?
That's very valid. That's very valid point, Stephanie.
I mean, you know, or it could just be like, hey, she's missing. I don't know. It's weird. And then the sister's like, okay, well, we have to call the police. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So further information, I think, is needed for you to really weigh in on how you feel about that.
I think so. And maybe I'm giving them too much grace, but at this point, I can't like totally point the finger at them.
Okay. Yeah. No,
knowing
that's good.
What I know.
That's good. It is strange, though, just on the surface. It is a little strange.
It is a little strange. I mean, the friend sleeping in the bed where my kid just disappeared from, that's more strange than these two things to me.
Okay. Fair. Either way, this case was looking less like an abduction, and the family was starting to look a little more suspicious.
Well, especially with the, you know, there's no ransom, there's no communication. It's just a little strange. And again, no forced entry.
Right. Well, so this is when the Attorney General, Alberto Bazbaz, began to focus more on the members of the household. And on March 27th, he ended up placing the whole household on house arrest at a local hotel. And once again, all four adults, Mauricio, Lizette, and the two nannies, were interrogated. After this questioning, Attorney General Bazbaz would tell local reporters that, quote, each one of them at a certain moment has falsified their statements, which has made it difficult to know the truth of the facts and clarify a firm line of investigation, end quote.
He didn't find any of them? I mean, four adults, he didn't find any of them to be completely truthful? Yikes.
Scary, right?
Yikes.
Attorney General Bazbaz found Mauricio and Lizette defensive and withholding, and they allegedly flunked polygraph tests.
Oh.
Now, Lizette didn't do herself any favors when it came to the likability factor, which we know means a lot.
I mean, in the court of public opinion, for sure. But also, I mean, with the police department, it really does make a difference whether you are cooperative or not.
I'll never forget. I used to work at a law firm, and the attorney I worked for, brilliant attorney, used to tell our plaintiffs every time they'd come in, when he'd go over like what the lawsuit's going to look like, he said, it will always boil down to this. Do they like you? If they like you, this is what will happen. And if they don't like you, this is what's going to happen. And it only doesn't matter. You know, the facts are the facts and the rules are the rules. Those are going to stay the same. But the only gray area is if they like you. And that's always stuck with me. So in this case, Lizette being not likable, not good.
Well, I mean, and even this is why defense attorneys never want their defendant in like prison garb. They always want them to dress appropriately and things because it makes a difference.
Absolutely. It really, truly does. Well, let me tell you what she did to hurt her reputation so badly.
Besides the coffee drinking and chain smoking.
Besides that.
Okay.
During one of these interrogations, Lizette jokingly claimed that maybe aliens or Harry Potter may have taken Paulette.
What?
Yeah. I mean,
what? Was she just being sarcastic?
Yes, I believe it. I believe they were made like in a joking manner. But again, your 4-year-old daughter is missing. Is this the place for sarcasm? Probably not. Again, you know, we can't judge how someone deals with this kind of trauma, but it didn't help the likability.
I can see that.
Didn't help the likability.
I can see that.
She was also caught on tape telling little Lizette not to talk about Paulette's disappearance or people would think they were guilty of hurting her. Now that's interesting.
Okay, so this one's kind of tricky for me. I don't know. I feel like a lot of these journalists, people that are interviewing, I feel like they do think take things a lot of out of context. And sure. Especially if you have a 7-year-old talking, you'd never know what they say.
That's
so
true.
I don't know. Again, I could be totally giving these parents like undue credit at this moment. But again, even that, I think I would probably advise a young child not to speak to the press. Not that I had anything to hide, but I just wouldn't want them to say anything out of context.
That makes sense.
That could be like misconstrued.
That's true. Because kids, who knows what they're going to say?
Oh, and they say some crazy things.
Right. And yeah, no, I can see that. But you can see how being caught, saying that, having that recorded isn't going to help with
Lizette is not doing any, she's not doing herself any favors right. over and over and over. I absolutely agree with you. I don't know that alone. Again, I haven't seen anything that definitely points to her being criminal, but again, she's not helping your case any.
Right. Well, how about this? And this is another thing that, you know, without the context could go either way. But Lizette also said that if she lost Paulette, it would be okay since she had another daughter.
Okay, no, that's just an ick factor.
Okay, right. Okay, so here's the, because I said, and see, here I'm the one giving a little grace on this one, because to say it'll be okay because I have another daughter, that I don't like. But if she said, I will have to be okay because I have another daughter, that
right.
I can understand. So again, without actually hearing her with my own ears and without the context.
As in, it could have been like, I'm going to have to be okay for my other daughter.
Exactly.
Even.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. I could see that.
If that's what was said. But what's been reported to have been said was that she would be okay. It would be okay because she had another daughter. That's what's been reported, which is hard to swallow.
If that is it on face value, yes, I think that would be hard to swallow. But again, I feel like, and some of that could even have been like the translation. I don't know. I feel like that's just such a nuanced statement. Again, maybe we're giving Lizette a lot of credit she doesn't deserve. But again, I feel like that's up to interpretation.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that for sure. Now, as we're discussing, on the surface, this seems like really strange behavior, especially from a mother whose 4-year-old is missing.
Yes.
However, Lizette was examined by a psychologist. This psychologist concluded that she suffered from a personality disorder that left her incapable of showing empathy or emotion. And her friends and family would confirm this diagnosis. So this was used to explain how she could say these things that seem so cold and uncaring. But my question is, does this disorder cause her to actually be cold and uncaring and therefore capable of doing something awful?
Is this disorder like she's a sociopath? What's going on here?
Exactly. Because when I hear she's incapable of showing empathy, that is a little
like, is she incapable of feeling it or has a hard time communicating?
Correct.
It?
Correct.
And big differences.
Correct. And that's what, you know, I don't know. That's where I don't have the reports in front of me. I have to assume that because this was used as a defense for her behavior, that what they were trying to say is that this disorder caused her to not be able to communicate, that she wasn't a cold, heartless woman with no feelings and no empathy.
Yikes.
She just wasn't able to properly, or adequately communicate those emotions in a way that other people could understand. But again, I'm just kind of guessing.
Either way, I actually feel bad for little Lizette and Paulette. That's very difficult to have a mother that either way, either doesn't feel empathy for you or can't communicate her empathy for you. That's challenging.
I actually have a friend who has a mother who I would say probably struggles in this area. And it was very challenging. Now, her mother loves her very much. And she's, you know, she's a good person. I really like this woman. But she really does struggle with, like, she's so tough and strong and a strong woman that she really struggles with any vulnerability at all.
Wow.
Even when it's really called for, even in one of those scenarios where you really need some empathy. And it is difficult on my friend, the daughter. So
sure.
Yeah,
it makes you almost feel, you know, appear not human.
Yeah, it's a I've seen that kind of behavior, and it is a little
challenging.
Yeah, a little hard. On March 31st, going on 10 days after Paulette went missing, someone noticed a foul smell coming from Paulette's bedroom.
Oh, I don't like where this is going.
You're not going to like where this is going. Around 2 a.m., the room was searched once again, but this time the findings were very different. Now, this search was actually video recorded, and at one point was even available to watch on YouTube if you could stomach it. And I have watched it. It's
Really?
It's hard for me to watch. In this video, you can see that at the foot of Paulette's bed, wrapped in a bodily fluid soaked blanket, was the tiny body of Paulette. And she was wedged between the foot of the mattress and the bed frame.
But this was searched before.
Girl. She was wearing her pajamas. And allegedly, she had been there the whole time. The whole time.
How is that possible?
I truly don't think it was. Authorities had checked this room. The nannies checked this room.
Someone slept on that bed.
Someone slept on the bed. The nannies said they moved the mattresses to check to make sure she hadn't gotten stuck somewhere, knowing that she was, you know, at risk for this kind of entanglement. What about the scent dogs being brought in?
Oh, yeah. I'd forgotten about them.
This is the part of the case that gets me. I truly, 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 from the bottom of my heart, do not understand how, if they were actually looking for her, and by they, I mean anybody.
Anybody.
Any one of these humans. Any one of the up to 200 humans who was coming and going. If they were looking for this little girl, how could they not have found her? Because you would literally, we mentioned it earlier, you would tear the room apart. You would tear the room apart.
Yes. Yes. And again, you would know the most likely place she would be is somewhere around the bed.
That's the first place. So you would rip every sheet off, every blanket, every pillow. I would be lifting the mattress up.
Of course.
I would. I mean,
there's no way she was
it's
there.
It's obvious.
There's
it's
no
obvious,
way she could have
right?
been there. There's no way she could have been there.
Allegedly.
There's no way she could have been there.
I mean, I'm with you. I'm with you.
And I don't mean for this to be like callous or off key or anything, but it took 9 days for them to smell anything.
Okay. There is an alleged explanation for that.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell you a little bit about like what the bed looked like and the setup, just so you can visualize it a little better. But because of the way they had the bed like so tucked in and like, you know, like those tight tucks tucked in
sure,
the bottom.
Sure. Like the military bed. Right. Yeah.
So because of all that, in an effort to like keep her immobile and safe, she was almost like mummified in the linens, and it literally entrapped it, like encapsulated and entrapped the scent.
So she was essentially like swaddled,
pretty much. I mean, okay. she was not swaddled, but she was just covered. She was just covered because they did, as soon as they removed all of the linens, the odor became very obvious. Okay, so let me explain to you a little bit like what her bedroom setup was. Now, there are lots of photos online, and honestly, I don't know at what point these photos were taken. Remember, the family is still continuing to live in the home. They are still, they are doing interviews in this bedroom.
I would say they're using that bedroom for multiple things. First, there was the initial search, then there was the television interview, then they have a friend staying in the bed, and then I'm sure they're like changing linens and stuff at some point.
Exactly. So in the photos, you can see like various, there's one photo where it looks like the bed was set up for Paulette with these long body pillows, like on either side.
Okay.
There's other photos where it just looks like a bed is made and those pillows aren't there. The same quilt is on it in all of the photos. So I have to assume that the same quilt that fit the bed, you know, was
sure.
continually.
Sure. Like her
on.
Bedspread basically.
Right. Yeah. Right. But as far as the bed goes, it's just this, think like a four-poster bed or like a canopy bed. It was custom made, supposedly to look like a ship, which it looks nothing like a ship in my opinion. But it's this four-poster bed.
Lost in translation for you. Huh?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. it's this four poster bed. And in all of the photos that I've seen, and from the description of the nighttime bedtime routine, all of the linens are tucked tightly under the bed, like all completely surrounding it. So what is that called? Like hospital tuck or?
Yeah. Military tuck. Yeah.
So because of the way the linens were like tucked in under the bed, somehow the theory is Paulette made her way down to the bottom of the bed and got like off of the bed. Like, so if the linens had not been there to kind of like catch her, she would have probably like just fallen, maybe like fallen to the floor. Oh, I see.
So off the mattress, but still within the sheets.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. So off the mattress. So she was between the mattress and the actual like footboard underneath the quilt or bedspread that was tightly tucked under the mattress. And that's where she somehow remained. And I know you keep saying that it's impossible. And I agree with you because it is impossible. Because if you looked for her, you would have found her. If you actually undressed the bed, like you said you did, you would have found her. If you, I mean, I'm with you. It's impossible. That's why this case baffles me, because it cannot be.
It's either one or two things. Either she wasn't there and was placed there, which I don't know, based on the way that you were describing they found the body, it doesn't sound like she was moved. But at the same time, then they could not have been searching in a diligent way.
And that means nobody was searching in a diligent way.
Because I mean, maybe it is that everyone just assumed the parents had done a thorough job of searching this very intimate bed area. And maybe all the neighbors were searching the complex or the neighborhood. I don't know. But again, she had mobility issues. It doesn't make sense. I'm with you. This is just none of it makes sense.
Allegedly, she was there the whole time.
Okay, I need to know more.
Okay. Well, first of all, now that they'd found a body, the police called this case a homicide. The coroner ruled the death as a result of asphyxia by obstruction of the nasal cavities and thoracic abdominal compression. Now, I also want to tell you that in the video where they found Paulette's body, the coroner is there.
Before they even found her?
Doesn't make sense to me. So again, some of this may have been lost in translation, but in several reports, I have heard the coroner can be heard saying in Spanish, they beat her to death. Because her body, you know, was discolored and there was bodily fluids and such.
Right.
So maybe upon first view, without thoroughly examining her, it looked as if maybe she had been murdered. After the autopsy was done, the coroner ruled the death as a result of asphyxia by obstruction of the nasal cavities and thoracic abdominal compression. Tests revealed that Paulette had eaten food at least 5 hours before she died. Now, the coroner did, throughout his investigation, change the time of death a few times. And some experts think that Paulette could maybe have only been dead for 3 days at the most. Whoa. That's not the coroner's official report, but that's what some experts believe after reviewing the case. But the coroner found that the lividity of the body was consistent with the position she was found in, and it did not look as if she'd been moved. Now, some of the theories for her having only been dead for maybe 3 days is, what if she had gotten down there but didn't die right away? What if it took her several days to die?
That is awful to think about.
It's even worse to think about.
Yeah.
But was not able to, you know, call for help or, no, that's even worse. But that could explain, I guess, if we're going to go with that whole, how could she have only been deceased for 3 days? That could be one explanation. There could be others, but.
Yeah.
Now, let me tell you this, because for people who do not think that Paulette could have been there the whole time, this is one of the little bits of information that they use. There's quite a lot of buzzing about the pair of pajamas that Paulette was wearing when she was found. She was wearing a solid colored green shirt and patterned pajama pants. Now, during one of the interviews that Lizette gave from Paulette's bedroom, you can see similar, if not identical, pajamas folded in Paulette's room, inferring that Paulette could not have been dead at the foot of the bed the entire 10 days because the pajamas she was allegedly wearing that entire time were folded in her room. A lot of people really put a lot of weight in this pajamas. For me, it means absolutely nothing without more information. You're shaking your head no, because we have kids. So we know.
You know, when they have a favorite outfit, they just want like 10 of them. They don't care. And it's easy. And it could have been her sister's. Who knows?
You got all the things I have. First of all, a lot of pajamas are sold with like a match, identical like print top and bottom. But then
absolutely.
Like a spare coordinating shirt. Like they're in three sets.
Yeah.
Her sisters could have been her sisters, could have been just a similar pair, could have been an identical pair. So, okay. So all the parents are with me saying this on its own without further information means
correct.
Nothing.
Correct. Now, if it would appear that the clothes, you know what I'm saying? Like if something didn't fit otherwise, then okay, let's talk about that. But just to say, I saw some in a photo. That right. looked similar to what she was wearing. That doesn't move the needle for me.
If they were, in fact, the pajamas she was wearing, if we knew that, then yes, obviously she couldn't have been there.
Right.
But we just can't say that's the case.
Okay, that's fair.
Now, interestingly, almost as quickly as the case was ruled a homicide, authorities changed their minds and said it was actually an accidental death. They said Paulette accidentally wedged herself between the mattress and the footboard and suffocated. Now, could a child with limited mobility accidentally get wedged between a mattress and another surface and suffocate? Yes.
Sure. That's the whole reason they had this very specific bedtime routine.
Exactly.
For that exact purpose.
And, you know, every mother knows for the first year of a baby's life, they're not supposed to have blankets, pillows, toys, anything in their bed. And I would, you know, for fear of entanglement.
Sure.
And unable to release themselves. And I would imagine that having a child with such limited mobility, you'd have a similar risk.
Sure. So
could she have died this way? I say yes, absolutely. What I don't think could have happened is her have been there for 9 days.
Well, and again, could this have just been an accident? Yes. Could it have been what happened? Yes. But if it was, they should have found her the next morning, the next afternoon, the next day. Like, this should not have taken 9 days to find her.
You are correct. Because, again, I think I'm probably beating a dead horse by now, but
no,
I would have ripped the room
that's
apart.
That's the mystery. That's the mystery here,
right.
Is how did you not find her?
Right. I would have literally ripped the room apart.
Right.
Last night, I somehow dropped my phone and it landed in such a way it landed in the bathroom trash can.
Okay.
Don't ask me how, because I don't know. I literally ripped the room apart looking for my phone.
Right.
Like, your kid? No. Yeah. No. Not buying it.
Especially when you know the likelihood of her getting stuck.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. Now, I will say, Paulette was tiny. So if you walked into the room and were not aware that a child was missing or had gone missing from this bed, would you have seen her? No. Would you have noticed she was there? No, absolutely not. But that's not the situation.
But these people
here
that know her intimately should have known.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 4-year-old Paulette Hebera Fara was buried at Panteon Frances Cemetery in Mexico City on April 6th, 2010.
Wow.
Now let's talk about a few of the most common theories. In another parallel to JonBenet Ramsey, a lot of people point to Paulette's mother, Lizette. The theory goes that Lizette killed Paulette either accidentally or on purpose. And all of the other scenarios, her missing, all of that was just a cover up. And the subpar investigation was maybe a result of the fact that they were, again, an influential family with friends in high places. I will say this, the Mexican law enforcement is not known for always being like on the up and up. At the same time, these are pretty serious allegations. You know, you're just going to cover up the death of a child or the potential murder of a child. Like,
well, and again, on our autopsy, it does appear it was just an accident. I mean,
true.
You know what I'm saying? So why go to such extremes to cover that up? I don't know. Something is just, it doesn't, it's not lining up for me.
With this theory, the ideas of why they would have tried to hide it. Say they went in that following morning and they found her and she had suffocated. The fact that it truly really wasn't a appropriate setup for a child probably with these issues. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that at the very, very end.
Not necessarily that they intended to murder her, but maybe they were negligent.
Exactly. That's one of the theories. I mean, there are other theories.
And I can see that. I mean, like you've said, I mean, I know for babies and toddlers, you don't want anything that could accidentally, you know, be pushed against their faces or, you know, positional asphyxia and all those kinds of things. So I get that. I had assumed maybe since they had these live-in nannies, like they kind of knew how to treat her case specifically, and this would have worked for her, but maybe that's not the case.
Well, there's one really interesting theory that I found that I was going to save for the very, very end. And if that theory holds any weight at all, which I think it could potentially, given that evidence, maybe there was a little more negligence than we're aware of. So hold tight for that.
Okay.
But for now, if Lizette was somehow involved, that may have been the concern, that maybe there would have been some negligence on her part.
Got it.
Or one of their parts.
Right. Sure.
Now, part of what helped fuel this particular theory is, you know, remember those separate vacations the family took?
Right.
Rumor has it that the friend that Lizette vacationed with was actually not just a friend, but a male lover. Now, both parties have denied being romantically involved, but allegedly Mauricio and Lizette's marriage had been on the rocks for some time. And Lizette may have only been staying in this relationship out of convenience and because she was worried that Mauricio might get custody of the kids.
Okay.
So is it possible Lizette lost her cool and accidentally or purposefully hurt Paulette? Caring for a disabled child is very stressful. Is it possible something went wrong and she snapped? Or is it possible that Lizette's alleged lover didn't like that Paulette required so much attention and it was motive to kill Paulette? I mean, it's insane to think about, but it happens. We know that. So just that's just kind of one theory. That's one kind of theory that's out there.
Okay.
Another potential theory is that an abduction was staged for a ransom. So the financial situation here, on the surface, the Farah family was successful, but Paulette's care was very expensive.
Sure.
Full-time caretakers, medications, specialists, nannies, physical therapy. And it was through all of these expensive treatments and therapies that Paulette was able to walk and talk. And if these treatments stopped, she would probably regress. Mm. So they couldn't stop the treatments. So despite making a pretty comfortable living, Paulette's care was still very financially draining on the family, and they were in some significant debt. So this theory goes that Mauricio and Lizette hid Paulette somewhere, perhaps an air duct in the building or possibly in an elevator shaft. And I will tell you that allegedly a neighbor in the building did complain about one of the elevators making a weird noise and acting strangely and almost acting as if it was hitting something in the week after Paulette went missing. So that's led people to wonder if maybe she was somehow hidden in that elevator shaft. Now, staging an abduction would have been an attempt to collect a ransom.
Right, which didn't happen.
Did not happen. Both parents came from wealthy families, so perhaps the thought was that Paulette's grandparents would be willing to come forward with a ransom payment. The theory goes on that at some point while being hidden, something went very wrong with Paulette. And perhaps the case got more attention than they planned and the whole situation kind of got too big too fast and the family wasn't able to go retrieve her from wherever they'd hidden her before she died. And by the time they did find her, it was too late and her parents had no choice but to somehow put her back in her bed and then stage the, you know, the accidental suffocation scenario.
This is all so horrible to think about. again, I feel like we're beating a dead horse because over and over, I'm like, something must have happened. And I could see this theory. Now, this theory that you've just said, there are so many uncorroborated, speculative parts of it. But based on what I think I know, yeah, it could definitely be likely.
It's totally out there and bizarre and sounds like a crazy, insane, made-up movie. And at the same time, it's kind of like, but it maybe could have happened. The only thing that about it, there was no ransom made. But again, that could be explained away by the fact that it just got too big, too fast, too out of control. The last time the parents were in the house was March 27th. Because remember, they were under house arrest while they were interrogated. So it means they would have had to have put her body back before March 27th. Now, I will tell you, going back to the whole idea that the parents like staged this kidnapping, in researching this case, there is a case where a woman did actually just that. She actually had her child hidden in a, I don't remember the exact details, but like in the basement or something like that of her lover's home in an event to like try to gain a ransom. And the idea was that somehow this child would be found. So it's not completely out of the realm of possibility.
Is the theory that like Lizette and Marisa were working together to do this, or Lizette did it on her own, or nobody knows?
Potentially either one, all of the above. I will tell you, and I left this kind of like out of my main script because I couldn't, it was more like hearsay, but allegedly, once these four adults got into like the interrogation room, they all kind of started turning on each other. There's rumors that, you know, Mauricio was pointing his finger at Lizette. Lizette's pointing her fingers at Mauricio. The nannies, Erica and Martha, are both pointing their fingers at both the parents. I couldn't really corroborate most of that. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess potentially anything is possible.
Yikes.
But that's that theory. But again, there's that whole, like, if that is what happened, they either had to put her body there before March 27th, or
meaning that so they couldn't have gone out and like retrieved the body, is what you're saying.
On March 27th, the family was put under house arrest, but not in the house. They were in a hotel. So it was called house arrest, but pretty much what it meant was they were taken to this hotel.
They were confined to a
hotel.
Okay.
And it was referred to as house arrest, but it was not in the apartment. House. Right.
Okay.
So the last time the family was in the apartment was March 27th. So if they'd had her up in the elevator shaft,
so she was at least there for 4 days.
If the parents put her there. The other possibility with this theory is that maybe someone else, perhaps a dirty cop or something like that, perhaps one of these friends in high places that the family had during the interrogation, maybe they learned what truly happened and they agreed for whatever insane reason to cover it up and they planted the body for them. Both of those seem kind of insane to me.
They are a little far-fetched, but I mean, what's the other option?
Well, the other option,
she was there for 9 days and nobody saw her.
That's the thing. They're all
like, they're all bizarre.
No matter what happened here, it was very weird. Another theory is that little Lizette may have hurt Paulette. And once again, the parents were forced to find a way to cover it up.
Boy, this really is like a JonBenet like callback, isn't it?
It really is. Now, some sources say that Lizette and Mauricio had had a big fight after returning home from these vacations. And this upset Paulette, causing her to get loud, which makes me really sad to even think about. And so in this theory, little Lizette tried to quiet Paulette and in doing so accidentally suffocated her. Aww. Because, again, we do have a cause of death.
Right.
Just because she died from suffocation and asphyxia, it doesn't necessarily mean she died at wedged in between a mattress and a footboard.
Yikes.
Now, just in case this doesn't already have you scratching your head enough, which I know it does, get this. In 2017, Lizette and Mauricio had Paulette's body exhumed. They then had her cremated.
What? I assume when you said exhumed, I was like, oh, to do more testing to find out if something else would happen. Is it something else is in her lungs or something? No. They just said, we're just going to go ahead and just destroy this.
They had her exhumed and then cremated I don't know the motive, but I do know that after she was cremated, none of those tests could be done. None. No. I mean, you know what I mean? It's very fishy. I mean, to have a loved one exhumed, I would imagine would be
you gotta have traumatic. A really good reason for that.
That just seems like a lot. And to do it, exactly, I think you'd have to have a really, really good reason. Why would you do that only to then have your child cremated? Again, no testing was done. Nothing else was done. They had her exhumed and then had her cremated.
Yeah, that's strange. Why did you decide to have her buried in the first place then? Like, why choose to have her buried if the reason was not nefarious?
Right, right, right.
Right, obviously. I mean, and that's kind of the conclusion. Right. Is why would you do that if it wasn't nefarious? And quite honestly, I can't really think of a reason.
I can't either. Now, again, maybe in the throes of that, you know, in the trauma and the grief, they weren't thinking clearly. Maybe they decided after the fact that, you know,
maybe they wanted her with them. Like, maybe they have an urn in their home or something like that now.
Maybe. Or maybe they decided, you know, we are going to be cremated. And so we, you know, there could be a valid reason. But without that motive, without their motive.
As an outsider looking in, that appears strange.
And even if the reason was good, it did do one thing. And that is to ensure that no further testing will ever be done.
Again, whether it was some malicious intent or whether it was just a personal choice, yes. Either way, it has taken away the possibility of doing any more testing.
You got it. All right. I told you that there was one kind of bizarre theory. The closest I can come to finding some kind of reasonable explanation for this, and even still, it doesn't really do it for me. But this case obviously has sent me down a rabbit hole.
Sure.
And so I was watching this video on the case on YouTube, and I was reading through the comments, and one user shared some information that I found very compelling that I just had to share. Now, this user's name is @Pomshka, and this person said that they, too, had gone down a rabbit hole on this case, and the following information is from, you know, police interviews and reports that they had been able to source from all over. So just do with this what you will. This is just a random comment on YouTube. However, I will tell you, a lot of it lines up with the research I did.
Okay.
This person believes that Paulette actually was in the bed the entire time she was alleged to have been. Pomshka said that the bed was a queen or king-sized custom-made bed, and they confirm that the bed was made to look like a ship. And interestingly, just, you know, for our listeners, they don't think it looks like a ship either.
A poorly constructed bedship.
Exactly. Long body pillows were placed on either side of Paulette and tucked into the sheets so she didn't roll out of bed while she slept. More confirmation of what I described earlier.
Right.
But according to Pomshka, the configuration of these pillows created a quote-unquote tunnel that led to the exact place where she was found.
I mean, it is true. I mean, so she can only go up or she can go down. I mean, she couldn't go anywhere else.
Exactly. Now, allegedly, Paulette had a habit of moving to the bottom of the bed, and she'd even fallen out of the bed at the bottom of it, at the foot of the bed, before. And that is why the nannies started tucking the blankets and the quilt in, like, underneath the mattress. And again, all of this lines up with the information we've already learned.
Which also, again, lines up. If all four of these adults knew that was a possibility, why did they not look there?
Well, true, true. Now, here's the crazy part, and here's where I talked about how potentially maybe there was some negligence. I don't know that it was nefarious, but possibly negligent. So allegedly, because this bed was custom built, conventional mattresses did not fit it properly. So instead, two mattresses were used, one on top of the other, and this fit the height of the bed frame. But the mattresses were still too short. So that left a gap either at the top or the bottom of the bed.
Okay.
The mattresses sat on top of a solid platform, and the bottom mattress was pushed all the way down against the footboard, while the top mattress was pushed up against the headboard. So there's going to be a gap under the top mattress and above the bottom one. So this left a little cubby at the bottom of the bed that Paulette could have fallen into and potentially gotten wedged into. Now, this person mentions that the bed was covered in pillows, blankets, quilts, a waterproof mattress cover, all of which would have, again, helped to shield the odor. The item given to the scent dogs was the bed sheet recovered from the bed when Paulette was discovered missing, and the dogs allegedly did alert to the bed on several occasions, but the handlers misinterpreted it as the dogs going back to the original scent.
I mean, I can kind of see that. And also, the handlers are going to assume, again, the four responsible adults had already checked the bed.
Right, right.
You know, wouldn't you think that? Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure people, you know, they've said they've already searched this.
Right.
Why would I think that there was a child in the bed still?
Right. But I will tell you, this idea for the dogs was like the big thing that I was like, oh, okay. Because I really struggled with the fact that scent dogs were brought in and didn't find the dead body at the bottom of the bed. But I can see the alerts being mistaken for something else because that's literally where they started. They had, you know, they're looking for a trail leading from the bed. So when the dogs,
I get that,
continually alert there, they're misinterpreting it. Now, again, how in the world somebody's been at the bottom? How we certainly didn't check that, the bed? I don't know.
Again, certainly that explains the scent dogs. But what about the other responsible adults?
Right, correct.
Who can't search a room correctly? I mean, just inept.
According to this person, Paulette was found with her fingers in her mouth, as was her habit, and her teachers confirmed that she did not like to be helped and preferred to do things on her own. So it makes sense that she would have been trying to, you know, get out of bed on her own.
This is really sad, Cynthia.
It's awful. It's awful.
This is awful.
Perhaps Paulette attempted to get out of bed on her own that day, and she shuffled herself down to the bottom of the bed, but she couldn't get out because the blankets were tucked tightly. And depending on what position she ultimately got trapped in, she could have even lost consciousness because, you know, maybe she's like in an upside down position. So by the time the nannies came to wake her up, she may have been unconscious. She may have already been deceased. We don't know. And again, I just want to preface this by saying, you know, I'm cautious of my sources and I can't really vet a fellow YouTube user. But the fact that this person told me that they got this information from interviews and police reports that they were able to gather, and then so much of what they found, I didn't find anything in their research that negated anything I'd found in my own.
Right.
So I thought it was pretty compelling. However, again, no matter how she died, I just don't think she could have been there for 10 days if anyone was trying at all to find her. So one of two things happened. Either she was put there later or every single person was a complete imbecile. I don't know. Do we need to edit that out?
No. I mean, it's kind of like that. Like, and maybe they were.
They may have been. I will tell you that the officials in charge took a lot of flack for this. This was obviously an embarrassment to...
Yes, can I say to you all idiots. Involved?
Right. And a lot of people still really question what actually happened to little Paulette. On a brighter note, should we talk about the Branch of Hope?
Well, if any case was rife for a Branch of Hope opportunity, this is it.
It is. It is. Paulette was such a incredible little girl, and I encourage you to just Google her photo because she was just all smiles and so sweet, and to know that she worked so hard to do things on her own and independent, despite the odds, despite being told one way or another she couldn't do these things and she did it anyway, it's pretty amazing. Yes. So because Paulette was affected by premature birth, for our Branch of Hope recipient for the month of May, we have chosen the Gift of Life 27.org. Their mission is to offer hope, encouragement, and support to the parents of premature babies in the neonatal intensive care unit, also known as the NICU. They have given more than 1,800 love bears to families, sent over 4,000 care packages, distributed almost 5,000 preemie hats, and supported nearly 6,000 families. 1 in 10 babies in the world are born preterm. So even if your family isn't a family that needs this kind of help, there is a huge chance that someone you know was or has had a premature baby. So we cannot think of a better organization to support this month than the Gift of Life 27, who works to help families affected by premature birth right here where we are in Central Florida.
And for anybody who's not familiar with our branch of Hope, we pick an organization that we highlight all month. And again, it's related to the first episode of each month. And a portion of our proceeds from our Patreon and sponsors are given directly to whatever organization we're sponsoring that month. If you are one of our Patreons, thank you so much, because a portion of your subscription is going directly to this organization, and we try to pick ones that really make a difference in our community and to the victims of some of our cases. If you would like to donate directly to this organization, you can find their information on our website or on our social media page. The stories we tell are entertaining and they do give us a bit of enjoyment, but we always want to remember that these are all based on real stories and real people. And we want to make sure that we kind of keep the humanness at the center of everything. And I really do feel like the Branch of Hope is what sets us apart from many other podcasts out there. We're not just doing this to be exploitive. We really want to keep some of these unsolved cases in the minds and hearts of people in the hopes of them one day being solved. And we also want to be able to give back to the communities that are affected by cases like the ones that we cover. We are simply trying to lead through words and actions. And if you loved this episode, I mean, you love us, you love what we're trying to do, we hope you spread the word. Please send this episode to someone who might like it. Tell them about us. Tell them about the Branch of Hope. You can also subscribe so you will never miss another episode of The Dark Oak. And you can always email us at thedarkoakpodcast@gmail.com. We are absolutely open to any of your questions, your comments, anything else you want to share. You have a case you want us to cover. And as always, you can connect with us at our website, thedarkoak.com.
Be sure to follow us to our next episode where Stephanie is going to give us a two-parter. I'm so excited. This is the highly requested case of Maura Murray. And you know Stephanie, you know how she's able to find stuff that nobody's ever reported on before. So I'm super excited to hear what she's able to share with us.
Yeah, I've got some new details. Her sister Julie has put out a podcast as well that gives us a lot of information. So I'm really excited to share some of that with you too.
We're really excited to hear about it and hopefully shine some more light on that case.
Oh my gosh, talk about another case. I want to be solved. Come back, friends. We love you, Shiver Seekers. You guys rock.
Bye. Bye.
This episode of The Dark Oak was created, researched, written, recorded, hosted, edited, published, and marketed by Cynthia and Stephanie of Just Us Gals Productions, and made possible by you, our shiver-seeking listener. Special thanks goes to Justice Himes for our incredible artwork and Ryan Crete for our amazing music.